The Catcher Podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Catcher AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are strapping in for an investigation that's, well, it's equal parts thriller, tragedy, and frankly, a profound warning.
Yeah, definitely. We're diving deep into Michael Lewis's really seminal work, The Big Short. Inside the Doomsday Machine.
Okay, so our mission today really is to understand the 2008 financial crisis, but not through, you know, dry economic charts.
Right. We want to see it through the eyes of the few people who actually saw it coming.
Exactly. We're trying to reveal not just what happened when the world economy imploded, but fundamentally why it happened and why Lewis argues it was both predicted and tragically, completely preventable.
And Lewis argues really forcefully, doesn't he, that this crisis wasn't some unpredictable black swan event, you know, that rare unforeseen thing?
No, not at all. He says it was the inevitable result of systematic fraud, these really perverse incentives, and something he calls willful ignorance.
Willful ignorance. That's a strong term.
It is. It means people in power actively chose not to see the truth. Why? Because, well, the delusion was making them incredibly rich.
And this book still matters so much today, right?
Yeah.
Because those central lessons about moral hazard and institutional failure, they're just timeless.
Absolutely timeless. And when we talk about moral hazard, what we mean is a system where, you know, the profits are private.
They keep the gains.
But the losses, they get socialized. The taxpayer picks up the tab. So you can get rich making incredibly reckless decisions because someone else absorbs the cost.
And Lewis shows how complexity, all that financial jargon, was basically used as a shield for exactly that kind of deception.
Okay, so let's unpack this. And you really couldn't get this story from, say, a standard academic economist. Lewis is, well, he's uniquely qualified. He was an insider who walked away.
Exactly. He's not just some observer looking in. He's a Princeton grad, sure. But he was also a bond salesman at Salomon Brothers back in the 80s.
Right, the liar's poker era.
Precisely. So that firsthand experience gave him this deep institutional knowledge of Wall Street culture, the mechanics, the jargon, basically the rules of the game.
And crucially, how those rules were being broken.
Yeah. That experience led directly to his breakthrough book, Liar's Poker, back in 89. That really established him as the guy who could, you know, lift the hood on that whole high-stakes, aggressive world of investment banking.
What I find fascinating is his perspective. He's kind of the outsider insider.
That's a great way to put it. He understands the really complex financial stuff, the mechanics, the jargon, because he lived it.
Mm-hmm.
But he kept enough critical distance to see through the pervasive groupthink that really took hold during the housing boom in the 2000s.
Yeah, and he has this incredible ability, doesn't he, to translate these really arcane financial concepts, things like collateralized debt obligations, CDOs.
Stuff that makes your eyes glaze over usually.
Totally. But he turns it into compelling human stories. He makes the mortgage bond market feel like a detective story.
Yeah, just like he did with abstract data in Moneyball or, you know, The Blind Side. He finds the human element, the drama, and makes the consequences feel real, emotionally resonant.
Which brings us to the book itself, The Big Short. It's structured like a narrative quest, isn't it? Following this small group of contrarian investors. Misfits, really.
Yeah, total misfits.
Yeah.
And they dared to bet against what everyone else believed, that American housing prices would just keep going up forever, never fall.
So the central premise is pretty simple but devastating. How did these supposedly sophisticated financial institutions, the ones meant to manage risk?
Right, their whole job.
How did they end up creating a housing bubble so enormous, so destructive, that it almost took down the entire global economy?
Lewis really digs into the mechanics of how it happened. He starts with the basic building block, the mortgage-backed security, the MBS.
Which is basically just a big bundle of thousands of individual home loans all packaged together into a bond.
That was the fuel, right?
That was the fuel. But the real, let's call it financial alchemy, or maybe just a magic trick, was the collateralized debt obligation, the CDO.
Okay, explain that simply.
Well, imagine you take all those MBS bundles and you slice them up based on risk. The CDO machine took the riskiest, lowest-rated slices, the stuff Wall Street itself called toxic waste.
Charming.
Isn't it? And through some fancy financial engineering, they claimed these bundles of toxic waste were actually super safe AAA-rated investments.
So they were essentially laundering risk,
turning
garbage into gold, supposedly.
That's exactly it. And here's where you see the systemic rot Lewis exposes. He shows how the rating agencies, you know, Moody's, S&P.
The supposed referees.
Right. Them, the investment banks, and people actually writing the mortgages, the originators, they basically all work together.
In concert.
Yeah. They package terrible, low-quality mortgages, those infamous liar loans, no documents, no down payment needed. Loans designed to fail, basically.
Pretty much. And they bundled them into securities that still somehow got that top-tier, risk-free AAA rating. Because everyone was making fees along the way.
But crucially, some people saw through the whole charade. We meet these misfits who recognized the bubble was going to burst.
And they figured out a way to bet against it, to short the market using something called credit default swaps, or CDSs.
Okay, so a CDS is like insurance.
Exactly. Think of it as buying fire insurance on a house you're absolutely convinced is going to burn down. If those mortgage bonds failed, the CDS policy would pay out massively.
They were insuring against a disaster they saw coming.
Precisely. So let's zoom in on these protagonists. Let's start with Michael Burry. He was really the first one, right? This section of the book feels like uncovering the very seeds of the fraud.
Yeah. Lewis sets the stage well. He shows how mortgage-backed securities, MBS, started as a potentially useful innovation, maybe to spread risk.
Right. Originally pioneered by Louis Ranieri, who Lewis actually wrote about before.
But by the 2000s, that original idea was totally twisted. It just became this giant machine for generating fees. Risk management, out the window. It was all about the fees.
And then you get Burry, this eccentric former neurologist, has Asperger's, runs his own hedge fund, Scion Capital.
And his big move wasn't listening to Wall Street gossip or analysts.
No, no. He did the really tedious deep dive work. He actually read thousands of the individual loan prospectuses inside these mortgage bonds.
Which nobody else was doing.
Nobody. He ignored the sort of human element, the sales pitch, and just looked at the cold, hard data within those documents.
And what did he find in those thousands of pages?
Something pretty damning. He saw that the underlying loans, the actual foundation of this entire housing market structure, they were basically designed to fail.
How so?
Because of things like adjustable interest rates. Teaser rates that were super low initially, but were set to reset very soon to levels that homeowners clearly couldn't afford.
So defaults were baked in from the start.
Absolutely. It was a housing market built on, well, fraud and guaranteed defaults.
Yeah.
Just waiting to happen.
So he's convinced disaster is coming. What does he do?
This is the wild part. The tool he needed to bet against the credit default swap on subprime mortgages, it didn't really exist in a big way.
Right.
So he had to go to the very banks making money off the bubble, like Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, and basically persuade them to create these CDS contracts specifically so he could use them to bet against the system they were profiting from.
Wow. He literally had to invent the weapon he needed to expose the whole thing.
Pretty much. He created the instrument. Okay, so if Burry was kind of lost in the spreadsheets finding the clues there.
Then Steve Eisman was the guy taking the fight out onto the streets almost.
Yeah, Eisman comes across as this really volatile, but also morally outraged Wall Street analyst. He ran a fund called Front Point Partners. And he became obsessed, absolutely obsessed with proving this wasn't just stupidity. He thought it was criminal.
He needed proof, right? On the ground evidence.
Exactly. So his team, they did serious due diligence. They took trips out to the bubble epicenters, Florida, California, places like that.
And what did they find there?
Just widespread predatory lending. Mortgage brokers openly bragging about forging applications, about putting people into loans they knew they couldn't afford. Entire neighborhoods built on debt that could never possibly be repaid.
And this really highlights that moral hazard point Lewis hammers home, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's crucial. Think about the chain. The mortgage originators, they made bad loans, but sold them off immediately to the banks for a huge profit. No risk for them.
Right. Get the fee, pass the trash.
Exactly. Then the banks, they packaged these bad loans into MBS and CDOs, sold them off, and collected massive fees. Again, passing the risk.
And the rating agencies, Moody's, S&P.
They just stamped AAA on this stuff, often knowing it was junk because they were getting paid huge fees by the banks to rate it.
So nobody actually held the risk long enough to care about the quality.
Precisely. Everyone was incentivized just to keep the machine churning, collecting fees, until it inevitably blew up. The incentives were completely broken.
And this leads us to what you call the ultimate tool of deception. The CDO machine.
Yeah, the collateralized debt obligations. Yeah. These things were built from the absolute riskiest slices, the toxic waste, of the mortgage-backed securities.
Okay.
But then they went even further. They created synthetic CDOs. Now, these weren't even based on actual mortgages anymore.
Where were they based on that?
They were basically just side bets, bets on whether other CDOs would fail or not. It was like buying insurance on someone else's insurance policy.
So it just multiplied the risk exponentially throughout the system?
Massively. It turned what might have been just a U.S. housing disaster into a potential global economic meltdown because the sheer volume of these side bets, these synthetic positions, dwarfed the actual underlying mortgages, complexity hiding immense danger.
Wow. Okay, so we have Burry, we have Eisman. Lewis also introduces a third group, right? Cornwall Capital.
Yeah, these guys are kind of the underdogs. Jamie Mine, Charlie Ledley. Lewis portrayed them as these young, really skeptical investors. Started small, almost like a garage band operation, as Lewis calls them.
And they weren't insiders like the others.
Not at all. They were looking for what they called asymmetric bets. Situations where the potential downside, the risk, was really small, but the potential upside, the payout, was absolutely huge if they were right.
And shorting the housing market was the ultimate asymmetric bet.
Exactly. If they were wrong, they'd lose the relatively small premiums they paid for the CDSs. If they were right, well, the payout could be 100 to 1 or more.
And their story really illustrates the sheer scale of the delusion, doesn't it? Lewis describes their trip to this big industry conference.
Oh, yeah. The American Securitization Forum in Las Vegas is an incredible scene in the book.
What was it like?
Just a picture of mass denial. Thousands of bankers, investors, salespeople, all celebrating their massive profits, totally oblivious, or maybe willfully ignorant.
Right. Back to willful ignorance.
Oblivious to the financial atomic bomb they had built and were sitting on, they genuinely believed the party would never end.
You have Eisman there, like publicly confronting speakers, disgusted by it all.
Yeah, yelling at people.
And the Cornwall guys just looking around, realizing the sheer scale of the madness they were betting against was even bigger than they thought.
It confirmed their thesis, but it must have been surreal. But being right wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. The path to actually winning that bet was agonizing.
Lewis really focuses on this, the psychological toll. It wasn't quick.
Not at all. Chapter 6 and 7 really detail this agonizing wait. Even though their analysis was spot on, the market just stayed irrational for a long time, those toxic bonds.
Yeah.
They weren't getting downgraded by the rating agencies like they should have been.
So the short sellers, Burry, Eisman, Cornwall, they were actually losing money initially.
Yeah, millions.
Yeah.
Because they had to keep paying these huge insurance premiums on their credit default swaps every month or quarter.
Yeah.
The clock was ticking against them financially, even though they knew they were fundamentally right.
That must have been incredibly stressful. The fear that you're right, but the world stays crazy just long enough to bankrupt you. Lewis really captures that anxiety, doesn't he?
He does. It's the feeling that your perfectly logical, data-driven analysis is fighting against sheer inertia, groupthink, and, frankly, fraud. They were risking everything, their funds, their careers, just waiting for the inevitable to happen.
Why did they stick with it? I mean, wasn't that kind of reckless, too, in a way? Just waiting.
That's the fascinating part. Their intelligence, their analysis, told them the ultimate risk of ruin was low because the underlying reality had to assert itself eventually. The loans were bad.
But the system was rotten enough to defy logic for longer than seemed possible?
Exactly. The depth of the fraud, the complicity of the rating agencies, the banks hiding losses, it propped up the illusion far longer than any sane person would have expected. The waiting, Lewis suggests, was maybe the hardest part, testing their conviction.
So when did things finally start to break?
The unraveling really begins in 2007. Big subprime lenders, like New Century Financial, start failing. Suddenly, the default spike. The predictions start coming true, undeniably.
Ah, vindication.
Well, yes and no. Because even then, Lewis shows there's this final layer of corruption.
What happens?
The big banks, the ones who sold the CDS insurance policies, the counterparties, they basically refused to acknowledge the bonds had failed.
Right.
They wouldn't mark the value of the swaps accurately because they didn't want to pay out the billions they now owed.
So even when the houses were clearly burning down, the insurance company tried not to pay.
That's a good analogy. They disputed the values. They stalled. They made it incredibly difficult for the short sellers to actually collect the money they were owed, even when they were proven right.
Unbelievable.
And then, of course, the final collapse hits hard in 2008. Lehman Brothers fails. AIG needs a bailout. The whole house of cards comes down.
And the protagonists, Burry, Eisman, Cornwall.
They cash in, they make billions, their bet pays off spectacularly.
But Lewis describes their victory as hollow.
Utterly hollow. They're vindicated, they're incredibly wealthy, but they're also disgusted.
Yeah.
Because what happens next? The government bails out the very banks that caused the crisis.
Right. The architects of the disaster face almost no real consequences, no jail time for the top execs.
Exactly. They were right, they won the bet, but they felt the system itself was fundamentally corrupt because it protected the culprits, socialized the losses, and left the country, the world, dealing with the wreckage.
That feeling of hollow victory really leads us directly into the core themes Lewis extracts from this whole mess.
Yeah. Theme number one has to be that moral hazard and perverse incentives point we touched on.
It's the engine of the whole thing, right?
Absolutely. The incentive structure was just completely broken. When you can get rich by being reckless, and you know someone else, taxpayers, will cover your losses if it goes wrong, well, what do you expect people to do? The system basically encouraged disaster.
It becomes a casino where the house never loses, but the public pays for the gambler's mistakes.
Perfectly put. Okay, theme two, the complete failure of expertise.
And Lewis really directs this at the credit rating agencies, doesn't he? Moody's, S&P.
Oh, yeah. He reserves some of his deepest scorn for them. They were supposed to be the impartial watchdogs, the guardians protecting investors and the public by accurately assessing risk.
But they weren't impartial at all.
Not even close. They were riddled with conflicts of interest. They got paid massive fees by the same banks whose products they were rating. So, surprise, surprise, they gave good ratings to bad products to keep the fees flowing.
They were essentially paid to look the other way, or worse, paid to lie. A complete failure of their duty.
Total failure. Which leads to the third theme, maybe the positive one, if you can call it that, the power of contrarian thinking.
Right. The heroes of this story, if you can call them that, were all outsiders in some way.
Exactly. A doctor with Asperger's, a cynical analyst nobody liked, a couple of young guys in a garage office. They weren't the mainstream Wall Street stars.
And they succeeded precisely because they weren't part of the groupthink. They trusted their own logic, their own data, even when everyone else said they were crazy.
Which really makes you reflect, doesn't it? How important is it to cultivate a culture, whether it's in finance or anywhere else, where dissent is actually encouraged, where people feel safe questioning the consensus, even when it's uncomfortable for the majority?
That's a huge takeaway. Now, Lewis is such a great writer. The book is just packed with these really powerful, memorable lines that just cut through the noise.
Yeah, they really stick with you.
Okay, let's talk about a few. There's one that really captures that moral discomfort of the short sellers. Lewis writes, they felt like men who had just seen a plane crash and had been the only ones to buy life insurance on the passengers.
Oof. Yeah, that perfectly captures it, doesn't it? That deeply uncomfortable feeling. Yeah. You are right, you benefited, but you benefited from predicting a tragedy that hurt so many people. That moral ambivalence.
Then there's a quote that gets at the why behind the complexity. Lewis quotes someone explaining, the whole thing the system depended on was people's willingness to be stupid.
Right. That's chilling, because it suggests the complexity wasn't accidental. It was designed to obscure the risk, to make it hard to understand, to basically facilitate that willful ignorance we talked about.
It makes it easier for people not to ask hard questions if they don't even understand what's going on.
Exactly. It's much scarier than just people making honest mistakes. It suggests intentional obfuscation.
And finally, there's that really sobering quote about the aftermath, about Lehman Brothers failing.
Yeah, the problem wasn't that Lehman Brothers had been allowed to fail. The problem was that Lehman Brothers had been allowed to succeed.
What does that really mean?
It means the failure wasn't the core issue. The real problem was that the system allowed a firm like Lehman, engaging in all that reckless behavior, fueled by those perverse incentives, to become so huge and interconnected in the first place. Its collapse was just the inevitable symptom of a system that was already deeply, deeply diseased.
The success was the problem because it validated the broken system.
Exactly. The failure was just the consequence.
Okay, so taking all this in, what are the real-life applications? What can you, listening now, take away from this today?
Well, for individual investors, I think the message is pretty clear. Embrace skepticism, healthy skepticism.
Don't just trust the experts plainly.
Right. Always question the conventional wisdom, especially when it comes from people who stand to profit directly from your decisions. And remember how the heroes in this book succeeded.
By doing the hard work themselves.
Yeah, by doing that tedious primary research, like Michael Burry actually reading thousands of those loan documents. Don't just rely on the summary. Dig deeper if you can.
Okay, what about for, say, business leaders or policymakers?
The big lesson there is follow the incentives. always. If you want to truly understand any system, could be a government policy, a corporate structure, a market, ask the most powerful question. Cui bono? Who benefits from the way things are right now?
Because incentives drive behavior much more powerfully than mission statements or stated ethics.
Absolutely. Understand the incentives, and you'll understand why things happen the way they do.
And for society as a whole, what's the takeaway?
I think it's always, always beware of complexity being used as a shield. If the explanation for something really important, like how our financial system works or how a new technology functions, if it's too complex for an intelligent, interested person to grasp,
then maybe the explanation isn't good enough, or maybe it's hiding something.
Exactly. Demand simplicity. Demand transparency. Because often, as Lewis showed with the CDO machine, that complexity is just camouflage. Camouflage for incompetence, or sometimes for outright fraud.
So wrapping up, Lewis really showed how these very basic human motivations, greed, fear, the desire to fit in when dressed up in complex financial jargon, could lead to, well, global disaster. For me, the most surprising or maybe disturbing takeaway was the sheer persistence of delusion.
Yeah.
Just how long people, smart people, could ignore overwhelming evidence staring them in the face simply because the status quo was making them money in the short term. That willful ignorance is powerful.
That's a strong point. For me, I think the biggest takeaway is just the profound warning the book offers. It's a caution that the fundamental flaws Lewis identified, the lack of real accountability for those at the top, the misaligned incentives, the moral hazard.
They haven't really been fixed, have they?
Not fully. There have been reforms, yes, but have the core issues been addressed? Lewis leaves you with the unsettling feeling that the system's architecture is still vulnerable. The moral hazard hasn't disappeared. And that's the enduring and, frankly, quite scary lesson of The Big Short.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.